If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Setlist, in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Shazam, Spotify and Touts. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me, actually with me this week, is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
We are back in the studio.
We are back in Shoreditch to record this week's edition of Setlist. We are not in Shepherd's Bush.
No.
Nor Margate. Mm-mm. Nor Kiev.
No.
None of those locations are involved in this week's edition.
East London, where all things should be.
I'm going to Bristol later today.
That's not in East London.
For the latest edition of the Industry Takeover Seminar with Urban Development and CMU DIY and the Multitrack guys in Bristol. So I could have recorded this edition from Bristol had I got a earlier train, and then I could have phoned in again. But didn't really seem like a desirable thing, given that it wasn't actually necessary.
No.
Also, I was kind of missing the studio because we haven't been in here for a couple of weeks.
It has been a while, hasn't it?
So I sort of want the familiar surroundings.
I've missed the soft walls.
Yes, we have not had soft walls for the last couple of editions. I'm back from Ukraine, just about.
Yes, I established that in the introduction.
I had a traumatic journey back.
Yeah, you did.
Because it snowed, and as we all know, it's such a cliche, it's even a cliche to comment on it. When it snows in England, everything stops. And so I was due to fly into Heathrow on Sunday and it snowed. And so, well, we ended up, well, it was 2 hours delayed when I got to the airport in Kiev. It was snowing there too. That didn't seem to...
it didn't bother them.
It didn't seem to bother anybody. It was like, yeah, it's snowing. So what? 2 hour delay because the plane was late because of problems at Heathrow. Then we got on the plane. It's like, okay, this is good. 2 hour delay, I can live with that. And the pilot says, oh, by the way, still problems at Heathrow. We're not going to take off for another 2 hours, but we thought we'd get you on the plane.
Because where's nicer to sit than a plane for a long time?
Who'd want to sit out back in the terminal next to the coffee bar with power and, I mean, not particularly comfy seats, but certainly leg room? No, let's sit on the plane for 2 hours. Although, after an hour, they said, oh, latest word from Heathrow, things are improving there. We can take off now. So that was good. And then they said, oh, but we need to de-ice the plane first. So a de-icing thing came and sprayed the airplane in de-icing stuff. And then I sort of wasn't
like
paying...
you get from Halfords.
Yeah, well, possibly. There's a lot of it. They would need to buy a lot of bottles if that was the...
well, they'd probably get a discount.
...stuff they were using. I was at this point working on my laptop, so I wasn't really paying attention. And then I realised we hadn't actually taken off yet. And then it turned out that the de-icing people had de-iced and gone away. But then somebody, and I think this was just a passenger, had noticed there was still snow on the wings, even though they'd just de-iced the plane. So the pilot was like, oh, we can't take off with snow on the wings. That a passenger randomly noticed. So they got the de-icer back, did a second de-icing. So actually it was 2 hours in the end before we took off.
Well, they'd had to go back to Halfords.
Exactly, to buy more bottles of de-icing fluid. Mm. And the nearest Halfords quite a long way away from Kiev airport.
So they'd have to fly, wouldn't they?
Yes, and they couldn't do that. So we took off. That was all fine. It was a 3.5 hour flight. After about 2 hours, my laptop ran out of power. Because bearing in mind, I'd been sitting on the plane for 2 hours working on my laptop before it even took off. So even though I've got an all right battery on my laptop, laptop dead. And then just as we were meant to be flying into Heathrow, he said, well, it was a British Airways flight, so the pilots are very charming.
Did they not have plug sockets?
No. British Airways long haul don't have plug sockets, let alone flying just across Europe. They haven't quite caught up with the 21st century yet. So we're meant to be flying into London, and the charming, very calmly voiced pilot said, we've been making good progress on this journey. We're actually ahead of schedule. But unfortunately, London is closed. We're going to Leeds. And so we flew to Leeds, which actually, my sister lives in Leeds. So I was the only person on the flight for whom it's like, well, okay, London would have been my first choice. I even would have accepted London Southend, even though it's cheating to call Southend Airport London Southend. But I would have accepted that. But if it has to be a non-London airport, then actually Leeds quite good for
me. At least it begins with L.
It begins with an L. And not only does my sister live in Leeds, she lives on the airport side of Leeds. So in some ways it was quite good for me. And actually, in some ways, it would have been fine. Well, it wasn't fine. I was in Leeds. I wasn't in London. There was no way it was going to be fine. But at least I could go to my sister's house and sleep for the night. Because by this point, it was sort of 8 o'clock, I think. Rather than have to work out how we were going to get back to London. It was really clear that we were not flying back to London. They were very clear about that.
Yes. They weren't, hence landing in Leeds.
They weren't quite clear of how we were going to get to London. But they knew we weren't going to fly. Anyway, landed in Leeds. I'm the only person on the flight thinking, oh, well, this is fine. I can go stay with my sister. We then sit...
Other people weren't thinking. Why didn't you offer how big's the house? They could have offered the sofa to a few people.
It's not that big a house. Although they do have two sofas, but they're sort of two-person sofas. You don't want to sleep on a two-person sofa,
Probably it's lucky you didn't mention
it. You'd have
it
to bend your legs. No one wants to bend their legs. So, yeah, we've landed. I phone my sister and say, can I come and stay at your house? And she was like, yeah, of course you can. And then we sat on the plane in Leeds for 2.5 hours before they would let us off the terminal. Bearing in mind, by this point, not only is my laptop out of power, my phone is now running out of power. And I've got a bit of a crap old phone, but even so, it was running out of power. Also, I did use that 2.5 hours to put my Brit votes in. So I did my voting for the Brit Awards. The voting site's really good on a phone. I was wondering, will it work?
I've never used it on a phone.
It's really set up for mobile voting.
Because it's a bit clunky otherwise.
But it did mean that my phone then ran out of power because I'd done my voting in the Brit Awards. So after 2.5 hours, we finally get off and they say, OK, you've got two choices. Either we'll get your taxi back to Heathrow now. Bearing in mind, by this point, it was like 10:30, nearly 11 o'clock. We'll get you a taxi back to Heathrow or you can stay the night in Leeds and get a train back tomorrow, and we'll pay for your train fare. And then they said, when you leave the terminal, we'll hand you a letter which will tell you everything you need to know. And so as we were leaving the terminal, this 19-year-old guy who didn't even work for British Airways handed us a photocopied letter that didn't even apply to our circumstances. It was clearly designed for people who were going to fly the next day. It was like, go into Leeds, stay the night, come back to the airport tomorrow, we'll cover your taxis and hotels. And I was like, well, that's not our deal. So I went to my sister's house. My plan was to Uber it. They have Uber in Leeds. They're a very sophisticated city,
Leeds. It's almost like London. That's why they started it with an L.
Almost like London. I was going to Uber, so I opened up my phone. I opened up Uber. There was an Uber driver about 5 minutes away. It said, we'll pick you up at the short stay car park. So I was just thinking, where's the short stay car park? Oh, I can see the short stay car park. That's really convenient. And I just went to book it. And that's when my phone died. Because I've been doing that Brits voting earlier. It's all the fault of the Brit Awards, really. So then I stood in the queue for a taxi. And I finally got a taxi. Bearing in mind, everyone else in the queue was waiting for a taxi to Heathrow. We're going to get a taxi to Heathrow. So I got a taxi to my sister's house. I had a very nice night there. I stayed for Monday at my sister's house, worked from there. And then I got my Virgin East Coast train back Monday evening. I thought I'd been really clever. I hadn't taken the stupid idea of a taxi to Heathrow in the middle of the night. I hadn't rushed to get a train first thing on the Monday morning, bearing in mind there would be hundreds of people trying to get to London who hadn't got there by plane. I thought, I'll leave it till Monday evening, which was the evening when Virgin Train on the East Coast broke down. And so I got stuck in a traffic jam of trains for an hour trying to get to London. But finally, they got rid of that train and they gave me a free, albeit disgusting, cup of coffee. For the hour wait, which is more than I got off British Airways. British Airways didn't even give me a disgusting cup of coffee. And finally, I got back to London. I've never been so pleased to arrive at King's Cross as I was on Monday evening. It did mean, the reason why this is relevant to our listeners.
Oh, good. Right, I was going to say, because this story is now almost as long as the actual journey.
The reason why this is relevant to my listeners is, because we didn't record last week's podcast in a studio, because I was in a hotel room in Kiev and you were in a loft in Margate.
Not a loft, but yeah.
I prefer to think of you being in a loft.
I think one day I might be.
Well, I look forward to that.
But not currently.
Because we weren't in the studio, I had to take responsibility for editing the podcast together. Because usually it gets done in the studio, but because we'd done it ourselves, I was going to edit the podcast together. I'm not quite sure why it was my job, not your job. Did we work that out?
Carry on with your story.
So it was my job to edit together last week's edition of Setlist. My plan was Sunday evening. Sunday evening's a good podcast editing time. I'll fly in from Kiev. I'll get to Heathrow about 4 o'clock. I'll be home by 6 o'clock. I've got the whole evening to edit it, ready for our traditional 6 a.m. Monday morning delivery. But I was stuck on a plane with no power. And then I had a very busy Monday and a very busy Tuesday. So that is why last week's podcast came out a little bit late. But fortuitously, nothing that we talked about, the stories hadn't developed by the time the podcast went live.
That's true. Other than, Leah Cohen has been announced as keynote speaker at South by Southwest. That's a YouTube-related story. There were a couple of YouTube mentions in that podcast.
we did occasionally mention YouTube and their planned new music service, which rumour has it is going to launch in March. As we said on last week's podcast, that seems ambitious, given that, as far as we're aware, only Warner Music are on board so far.
Although it could be that, one, it could be that they're hoping to launch it when Leo Cohen gives his keynote. It could be that some wires were crossed and actually they're not planning to launch it in March. It's just that Leo Cohen's giving a keynote in March. And someone heard something on the grapevine that was happening in March, and that's why that happened.
Perhaps he's going to unveil it. He doesn't necessarily mean he's going to launch it.
He could show some screen grabs.
He could announce officially that they are going to launch a streaming service at some point in the future, like they did with Music Kit.
Yes, I mean, i.e. never.
If he's announcing it's going into beta, if the beta's as long as Music Key, it will be several years before it launches. In fact, it will never launch. So perhaps that is what he's going to announce at South by Southwest in March. Anyway, now that I can tick British Airways dissing off my list, because I have got all that out there, let's get on with this podcast, which is actually quite light on YouTube news, I think.
That's right, yeah, because this week we're going to discuss raids and arrests in the world of secondary ticketing, plus Spotify and Deezer teaming up to take on the big tech firms.
Which does include Google.
Google being one of them, so what you said before was wrong. But first, let's talk about Shazam, and one of the other big tech firms. You might have heard of it. It's called Apple. Apple has bought Shazam. Shazam being the music identification app that you probably have on your phone. The deal for Apple to buy it was rumoured earlier this month and then confirmed last week by Apple in an uncharacteristic public statement about an acquisition. Because Apple, I suppose they announced Beats, didn't they? Apple tends to be quite quiet about things it's acquired, to the point that companies it's owned for several years are still not allowed to tell anyone that they're owned by Apple.
I suppose a lot of the little tech startups that Apple acquires don't necessarily have a public profile.
No.
They're not necessarily consumer-facing. So you're right, when it acquires those companies, usually because it wants to access those companies' technology or their people, not because it necessarily wants to carry on using the brand that comes with that company. They can be very secretive about those deals and never officially admit that they did indeed buy those companies. But yes, when they bought Beats, which is obviously a big consumer-facing brand, and of course, although they were in part accessing that company's technology and their people, they were also actually buying the brand. Because although they got rid of the Beats Music streaming service in order to launch Apple Music, they do continue to sell shitty headphones with Beats by Dre stuck on the side. So they were interested in having the brand, hence why they did make quite a big announcement. So it's interesting with this, we don't actually know what bits of Shazam it is that Apple were most interested in, but it is a consumer-facing brand that a lot of people are familiar with, which is presumably why, yes, they did put out an official statement in which they said they were thrilled,
yeah,
to have purchased Shazam.
The deal's rumoured to be worth $400 million, which sounds like quite a lot of money, although it is quite a lot less than the $1 billion valuation Shazam had fairly recently.
Yeah, Shazam's an interesting company, isn't it? It's been around an incredibly long time. It was one of the very first audio identification systems, certainly to be made available directly to the public, because in the early days of Shazam, well, it precedes smartphones, doesn't it?
Yeah,
because originally
yeah.
It was an SMS-based service.
Yeah, you used to call it up and just over the phone, like hold your phone in the air, pointing at whatever music you wanted to identify. And then a few minutes later, it would text you back the name of that song. And it would charge you £1.50 for that privilege.
But in the early 2000s, that was very high tech. So people presumably thought it was worth £1.50. It was also in a period where people still used to pay for individual text messages, didn't they? So they were used to anything on a mobile phone being stupidly expensive.
Yeah, and then when Apple launched the iPhone, it became an app where you just pressed a button on your screen, it would listen to the music and then there and then tell you what it was. And the significant change there was that the service was free. So it obviously gained a lot more users by being more readily available on smartphones and cheaper, but it was so cheap that it was no longer making out £1.50 a time from that service.
Or indeed, any pennies at a time, yes, given that it was free. But I suppose the original...
But the brand recognition.
Well,
oh,
the original service, not only did it predate the iPhone, it predated iTunes. I mean, that's how early Shazam came to market. And I suppose by the time the iPhone was launched, what they could do within the app is when they identified the song, they could then try and upsell you the download. Take, yes, you to iTunes and try and sell you the track. So I suppose the idea was, okay, we've got this audio identification technology that can listen to some music and tell you what it is. The mere act of identification used to be the product, but in the smartphone era, the business will be, we'll do the identification bit for free, but hopefully a certain number of people, once they're told what the track is, will then want to own it. And then we'll take them through to iTunes, they'll buy the track off Apple, but we will have an affiliate fee for securing that sale, and so we'll get a little kickback every time a download is sold. And I suppose, again, in the early days of the iPhone, I would imagine a significant number of people who are... Did we ever make Shazamming a verb? They used to talk, yeah, about tagging the track, didn't they? Rather than Shazamming the track. But can we say to Shazam?
I think that's what people would say.
Okay, so when Shazamming the track... Sometimes it would be a new track that maybe you'd heard a couple of times on the radio and you wanted to know what it is. The fact that you are Shazamming it means you presumably like it, so you might want to buy it. Having said that, often you're Shazamming a track from way back and it's a sort of, oh, I remember that track. I can't remember what it was. Tell me, Shazam, what is that track? So would people want to buy the old track? But we were still in the 2000s, and so just about still in the period, I guess, where some music fans were rebuying catalogue music off iTunes, yeah, for tracks that they probably already owned on CD somewhere, but it was just easier to pay the 79 pence to download it. So I think in the early days of the Shazam app, although they were earning little sums of money on the downloads, and it wasn't even guaranteed by any means that everybody using the app would buy any downloads, but iTunes was booming at this point, so to get a little bit of money off every iTunes sale, there was potentially a decent business there.
There is, and obviously it's a massively popular app as well. It was one of the, I think, especially in the early days of the iPhone, it was one of the wow apps that if you were showing someone a smartphone, back when most people didn't have a smartphone and they'd say, well, what can it do? You go, well, look, it can do this. I can tell you what this bit of music is. And that was a thing of you'd show off your iPhone with.
Providing the person hadn't been using the old version of Shazam and therefore wouldn't
Which
be impressed
nobody was.
By audio recognition. I know at least five people.
I did occasionally use it, but it was £1.50 a time.
Who were very into it in the early
days. I wasn't using it to show off my Nokia 3310 to people. But because it became such a massively popular app, it also had that other thing that people like, data. And it does also have a business-facing app where people at labels or whatever can see what tracks are becoming popular that can be used for predicting various things or tracking new music. And Shazam reckons that it generally identifies which tracks are going to be popular about a month before they actually hit the US charts. So that's obviously of value for various different people in various different bits of the music industry. In fact, that might be one of the things that Apple is interested in when it comes to playlisting on Apple Music and possibly also programming on Beats 1.
I remember once hearing, and I think this is true, and this isn't just a Shazam-related urban legend, but once Shazam was on all the smartphones, and as you say, once it started to be used a lot because it was now free to use and they were starting to build all this data, Shazam started sending out little data reports to music companies and to media like us. We used to receive it, you know, sort of top-line information of the most Shazammed or tagged tracks in the last week and tracks we think are going to be big in the next few weeks based on the Shazam data. And they would send that to everybody for free. And the story went that there was one week where, because of some technical problems, they didn't send out that weekly alert to the industry and to media. And suddenly everybody was phoning them up saying, where's our Shazam data? And like, I think it was probably Radio 1, the playlisting team were like, where's our Shazam data? We've got a playlist meeting. We need your stats to help us playlist the station. And that was the point of like, whoa, a lot of people are using our data to help them with programming and playlisting. So yes, Shazam, the original model was charging an extortionate sum of money every time you wanted to recognise a track. The next model was, well, we'll upsell downloads and we'll take a cut of that, which worked because at that time iTunes was booming. But then, of course, iTunes peaked and downloads went into quite steep decline. So it became clear that building a business around taking a cut on download sales was not going to have a long-term success rate because download sales were now going down, down, down every month, every year. So what else could Shazam do? And as you say, all of that data sitting over here. So in addition to giving out these free weekly reports, is there a data business we could build on that? They also sort of expanded what it was that they recognised, and they started building a brand's advertising side to the business. And can we make this audio identification technology available to other content owners or brands and try and bring in some extra revenue in that way? So they certainly diversified the business. But if you look at the figures, we don't get hugely detailed financials from privately owned companies, but we do know they had a couple of years where their revenues were going down because that original We Take a Cut on Download Sales business had started to decline. Things did then improve a little in 2016, but they were one of those companies where it's a case of you've got a great app, you've got quite big brand awareness amongst music fans, you're sitting on all of this fabulous data, you have a few revenue streams over here, but how are you going to make significant sums of money in the future? Particularly given that you've now raised so much investment over the years that you've got a $1 billion price tag that you need to live up to. And so I think a lot of people who pay attention to these things did feel over the last couple of years, probably the logical outcome for Shazam is for somebody to buy it, either a big media owner or a big tech company who can take aspects of that service and do something with it. Which poses the question, now that Apple have bought it, I mean, you said perhaps it's predominantly the data that they're interested in, or is it the actual audio recognition technology? Spotify earlier this year bought a much younger startup that has a similar audio identification system.
Yes, Sonalytic. And apparently Spotify were one of the companies interested in buying Shazam, as was Snap, the owner of Snapchat. But Apple got it. I mean, Apple obviously have had a tie-up with Shazam for some time. It's built into Siri to a certain extent. They've been fairly closely aligned for a while, so it is kind of an obvious purchase for Apple. And also, I mean, obviously, it stopped Spotify getting it. So that's got to be a bonus.
Well, that poses the next interesting question, doesn't it? Because, as we say, there are various reasons why an Apple or whoever might want to buy Shazam. Is continuing to distribute and monetize the Shazam app one of the things that they want to do?
Because how as well. It's interesting. The one thing we haven't mentioned is advertising. Shazam app carries advertising as well, and Apple apps do not do that. Apple sort of has positioned itself as the big tech company that isn't ad-funded. It's not Google. It's not farming all this data to build an advertising business. So will they? I mean, presumably, I think it would be silly to make Shazam disappear and turn it into a feature of the iPhone. I think it makes sense to keep it as a standalone app. But will it continue to be an ad-funded app?
The other question on the app front is, at the moment, once you've tagged or Shazammed a track in Shazam, it still tries to sell you a download, although most people won't want that. It also says, would you like to listen to this track on Spotify or on Deezer or on Google Play? And at one point, they did some deals with those streaming companies when streaming was first starting to boom. And I think part of the deal was, if you weren't an existing Spotify subscriber or Deezer subscriber and they happened to upsell a subscription, they would get a cut of that in the same way they got a cut of the download money. But presumably an Apple-owned Shazam app won't be sending people off to Spotify or Deezer or Google to listen to the music.
Well, I did read one thing that was saying one of the things Apple might be interested in would be to see, like, although it sends you off to those streaming services, the Apple Music bit is the big thing that it first points you towards, is like, you know, stream this or download this. And it would be interesting to see the analytics for how many people click through to Apple Music and how many people then buy a subscription. But it would also give Apple the data on who clicks through to Spotify and then signs up for a subscription to Spotify. So actually, it could be the other streaming services that don't want to be in the app anymore now it's owned by Apple, rather than Apple wanting to drop them from it.
And if we do look at this as primarily a data acquisition, which is a speculation, but it's certainly a decent speculation, there was that flurry of acquisitions a couple of years ago where you had these digital music data-based companies like Music Metric and Next Big Sound, and then Music Metric got bought by Apple and Next Big Sound got bought by Pandora. And immediately, all the other streaming services who had been allowing those two companies to collect and analyze their data were like, well, you're not having our data anymore. Yeah. Now you're owned by Apple, now you're owned by Pandora. Spotify also bought the Echo Nest, which wasn't a direct parallel to them, but they were a company that specialized in grabbing data from streaming and analyzing all of that. So something similar happened there. So yeah, I think you're right. It may well be that Spotify, Google and Deezer demand that they're removed from the Shazam app before Apple decide that they don't want them in there. So Apple's announcement of this deal did mention the acquisition being approved. So that's presumably regulator approval before it actually goes through. But once Shazam does become an Apple subsidiary in 2018, it will be interesting to see quite what happens to Shazam, which bits of it are Apple actually interested in, the technology, the people, the data, the brand, the app. As you say, on one level, it would seem foolish for Apple to dump the Shazam app because it is so popular, it has such a big reach. Although I have to say, it wouldn't surprise me if they merged it into the Apple Music app and made it part of the Apple Music experience. I think that would be a stupid thing to do, but I think Apple I think Apple may well do that. But we'll see, I guess.
Still to come, the latest crackdown on illegal secondary ticketing, plus some news in brief. But now, Spotify boss Daniel Ek and Deezer CEO Hans-Holger Albrecht have sent a letter to European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker, urging him to ensure that the streaming company's tech giant rivals can't abuse their position as gatekeepers to the digital consumers. Those tech giant rivals obviously being Apple, Google and Amazon.
Yes, in some ways, this is a continuation of the story that we discussed in quite great length on last week's set list about Apple and Amazon and Google all bickering over each other's platforms and devices and content services.
Yes.
Because Apple doesn't like it when Amazon pushes its content services, and Amazon doesn't like it when Apple makes it difficult for other people to have their content services on Apple, and Google was in there somewhere, and so on and so forth. So they're all bickering with each other. Meanwhile, you have the Spotifys and Deezers of this world, content services who rely on those big free tech giants to sell devices and apps via which people can use Spotify and Deezer. And the concern is that those free companies are abusing their market dominance in order to prioritize their own music services over the standalone music services like Spotify and Deezer. So that's basically what this letter was alluding to. It wasn't just Spotify and Deezer who were signing this particular letter to the European Commission. There was also representatives of the gaming sector who signed it. It's also not the first letter of this kind, because both Spotify and Deezer also put their signatures to a similar letter to European lawmakers back in May.
And as we discussed recently, Spotify and various other independent tech companies recently started up their own lobbying group in Europe to act separately from Apple, Google and Amazon when the big issues for them are being discussed.
Yes, and that organisation is called Digital Music Europe. It made quite a big deal about how it was representing the various different European digital music companies, which of course is sort of code for saying not Apple, Google or Amazon, all those terrible American companies. And although when Digital Music Europe officially launched very recently, they said that the organisation had been set up to lobby on various different issues, it does feel like this particular issue is at the top of their agenda, because these letters, both the one that went out last week and the one that went out in May, it's all specifically timed. There is a reason why Spotify, Deezer, etc. are writing to the European Commission now, because the European Commission is considering new regulations about how the big tech companies that have app stores and app platforms, how they deal with the makers of apps, whether those be Spotify and Deezer and other music and video content providers, or whether they be games that you play on smartphones. What is the relationship between the app store owners and the device makers and the people who make all of those apps to try and ensure that an Apple and an Amazon and a Google don't abuse the fact that they own the app stores, they make the devices, and so where they are also active in, for example, music and video on demand, can they skew things? Can they charge fees on everybody else's sales so that it makes an Apple Music, an Amazon Prime Video, those sorts of services seem better priced and more attractive to consumers than the third-party standalone services?
Yeah, so the letter called for clear and enforceable obligations that are a deterrent and prevent unfair business practices by platforms. They're a little bit vague about what they actually want, but really it's the Apple tax, isn't it? They don't like, and the similar charges that Google applies when people purchase things through third-party apps on their systems. So, for example, when you buy something through an app on your iPhone, Apple takes a 30% cut of that purchase. So if you're buying a Spotify subscription, Apple's going to take 30% of that. 30% is the absolute best profit margin that Spotify hopes for, so that's not really going to work. And therefore, Spotify has to pass that on to the consumer. So if you sign up for Spotify through your iPhone, you actually pay $12.99 a month rather than $9.99 a month for it. Whereas an Apple Music subscription, because Apple waives the 30% cut on there, is still $9.99. So it looks, unless you go and check it out, or someone tells you, or you see it somewhere, you would think that Spotify is more expensive than Apple, and therefore that makes Apple Music seem more desirable based on price.
We alluded to Apple tax last week when we were discussing the whole Google, Amazon, Apple stuff, And I think we have discussed it in quite some detail on past editions of Setlist. But the one other thing to add is, you mentioned at the start there that Google also charges a 30% cut when people buy stuff through apps that are delivered through Android. And the Spotify's and Deezers of this world don't like giving Google 30% any more than they like giving Apple 30%. Although, people resent the Apple tax more than the Google Android tax because of other Apple rules. So not only does Apple want to take 30% of the money, it won't let you, within the app, tell consumers that that is what is happening.
Yes.
So Spotify is not allowed to put a little alert within the app when people go to subscribe that says, hey there, if you subscribe here, you're going to pay $12.99 a month. If you were to go to Spotify.com through a browser on your phone, it would be $9.99 a month. And then you can log in with whatever email address and password you give us back in the app and stream through the app on the $9.99 standard subscription price. That would be quite a clunky little box to explain all that.
It was quite long. Anyway. I'm not sure you'd get all that on one screen.
But Apple rules say you're not allowed to do that anyway. And so that makes the Apple tax even more annoying than Google, because you're not allowed to direct people. And as you did say on last week's set list, the result of that is, away from music, on Amazon Prime's video app. If you're an Amazon Prime subscriber, through the Video On Demand app, you can stream a load of content, but there's also a load more content within the app that you can't stream through your Prime subscription, but which you can download or rent from Amazon, but not through the app, because they don't want to pay 30% to Apple.
And they don't even tell you, really, that you can do that.
Because they're not allowed to, presumably, because of Apple rules. So it's a really confusing consumer experience where it says, oh, sorry, you can't stream this, but you can download it. But we're not going to tell you how. We're just going to assume that you will now go to our website and do whatever transaction you need to do in a place where we don't have to pay Apple 30% in order to access this. So yeah, this whole paying Apple, Google their 30% is a particular bugbear. There are some other issues, and they were also mentioning back to data. The data that does, or in most cases does not, flow through the App Store when people subscribe in that way. So there are some data things as well, and some other gripes, but Apple tax and the fact that you're not allowed to alert consumers to that issue is, I'm sure, very high up the list. So we'll be interesting to see in 2018 what rules and regulations the EU considers to try and constrain Apple, Google and Amazon, all of whom I'm certain will say that the fact there are three of them reduces monopoly fears. But yeah. That's no use if you're a Spotify or a Deezer or whoever. But it'll be interesting to see what the EU proposes. And also how effective this new Digital Music Europe body is in trying to ensure that the standalone independent music services get their voice heard too.
Just quickly, time for some news in brief now. Tidal's running out of money and it will be gone in 6 months. That's the news.
According to a Norwegian newspaper.
Yes, and it does sort of seem like they based it on, well, a couple of things. One, Tidal lost quite a lot of money last year. And two, about a year ago, someone from Roc Nation, not even Tidal, but Roc Nation obviously being the owner of Tidal, they said that the deal to sell 33% of Tidal to Sprint, the US telephone company, gave them 12 to 18 months of working capital. So they put those two things together and said, well, that means they've got 6 months left and then they'll run out of money.
It's also worth adding that the executive who said the 12 to 18 months thing at the start of the year, not only did they work for Roc Nation rather than Tidal directly, they also work for Roc Nation Sport.
Yeah.
Because Jay-Z's Roc Nation business is also in the sports business. And so it was a guy who's responsible for the sport side of Roc Nation who made those comments, who you assume doesn't have access to all of the information about Tidal, which not only is a separate company, but is more closely aligned to the music side of Jay-Z's business.
Tidal's statement on this was that they're quite used to having negative stories written about them. It's happened ever since they started, and yet they continue to grow, so there.
So shut up, Norwegian newspapers. The reason why Norwegian newspapers show a particular interest in Tidal is obviously Tidal grew out of a Norwegian streaming company that was originally called Wimp, and so I think Norway still thinks of Tidal as theirs. And I think technically the corporate entity that controls it is actually a Norwegian company still, although really, as far as I can see, certainly from a marketing and brand side, it is very much run out of the Roc Nation offices in the US.
Sticking with foreign newspapers, Der Spiegel in Germany has released audio of an interview with Morrissey after Morrissey claimed that the newspaper basically made up the interview and used the fact that it hadn't released the audio as apparent proof of this.
Yeah, so Morrissey gave an interview to Der Spiegel a few weeks ago. It was a classic Morrissey interview in which he said all of the contentious, controversial stuff that you would expect. Pro-Brexit, down on multiculturalism, we knew that. He also unwisely decided to comment on the whole Harvey Weinstein scandal that has rocked Hollywood, and other allegations of sexual harassment and sexual assault that have been made against other big-name celebrities, in particular the allegations that have been made against Kevin Spacey. And, well, his remarks were suitably controversial. Unsurprisingly, as this always happens, once that interview had been published and once the rest of us in the media had reported on the more controversial quotes, he then said, "Ah, misquoted, that's what I said. I will never do another interview."
Print interview.
Well, I suppose, to be fair, there is a difference between giving an interview to a newspaper magazine versus on TV, radio, in that inevitably when the journalist writes the interview up, they're not going to directly verbatim quote you, because if they did, it wouldn't make sense. So there's always a little bit of editorial process going on there. But yes, I was misquoted, was Morrissey's line. So Der Spiegel put the tape out.
Yeah, the full 43-minute unedited interview.
And most of what he was quoted as saying.
He said all the things.
Definitely in there.
He said all the things that he denied saying and all the ones that he didn't even bother denying, even though a lot of them were worse than the things he was denying.
So Morrissey continuing to be Morrissey there.
Yeah.
Famous contrarian, occasional singer-songwriter. We were going to make this a main story on this week's set list because actually there was quite a lot to say and we could have given you some of the quotes and gone into it in a little bit more detail. But Andy couldn't face the thought of spending 10 minutes of his life talking about Bloody Morrissey.
I didn't think this story would just drag on for so long, and it's just dragged on.
Well, let's stop dragging on with this.
We got a
complaint in brief
about it this week.
Did we?
For giving undue importance to what Morrissey was saying, especially when he wasn't being funny. That was one of the things.
He is occasionally funny.
Not on this occasion. And finally, the BBC, despite everything, actually we ended up giving it quite a positive review.
You did.
I think. The BBC has ordered another series of Sounds Like Friday Night.
The all-new primetime music show on BBC One. They did 6 test editions.
Apparently it's been a massive success,
says the BBC. And
so they're going to have 6 more.
They're going to return for a spring series, more celebrity guests, more top pop stars performing their songs, hopefully fewer comedy skits.
Yeah.
They didn't really work.
Nope. That said, since we last discussed it, I haven't actually watched any more. So it's possible that by episode 6, the comedy skits were fantastic.
It was gold comedy.
But the first 3 episodes, nope.
Having not watched any of those episodes, I'm going to guess that they didn't get better.
No.
So second series of Sounds Like Friday Night coming in 2018. Whether or not it will become like Top of the Pops was in the olden days, a show that airs for a big chunk of the year, not sure whether that is potentially on the agenda. Certainly they're wheeling out Top of the Pops for Christmas specials again. You'd think with this big new brand, they might want to do a Sounds Like Christmas Day. But
yeah,
perhaps they'll do that in 2018. We'll see.
Well, given that I'm not sure that anyone actually watches Sounds Like Friday Night on Friday night, they could probably do Sounds Like Christmas Day, I don't know, in January sometime.
Well, they always pre-record those Christmas specials several weeks before Christmas Day anyway, don't they? And then have everybody in the audience have to pretend that it's actually Christmas Day.
And they gave up their Christmas lunch to come into the studio. Yeah, well, you can read more about all of those stories and more at setlistpodcast.com, where you'll find links in the show notes for this episode. And finally this week, National Trading Standards raided 4 properties in the UK last week in relation to alleged misconduct in the ticket resale market, i.e. Ticket sellers doing stuff they're not allowed to.
Imagine a ticket tout being a bit dodgy.
I know, it's hard to imagine.
Apparently somewhere out there are slightly dodgy ticket touts who have been disobeying the rules.
There aren't a lot of rules in the UK. The secondary ticketing market, I mean, outside sport, is fairly lightly regulated. However, there are some rules that were laid out in the 2015 Consumer Rights Act, as much discussed on previous episodes of this show.
And also industrial level touts, the people who are basically touting as a business, beyond the specific rules for secondary ticketing, which are mainly contained in the 2015 Consumer Rights Act, there's a whole load of other consumer rights law that they have to follow simply by being a consumer-facing business, which at least some touts haven't done a very good job of following. So although, as you say, on one level, secondary ticketing in the UK is quite lightly regulated, there are a bunch of rules and regulations that people should be following. Although it's interesting that when the anti-ticket touting campaign has been speaking, and obviously, as we've discussed at great length on Setlist, the anti-ticket touting campaign has become increasingly vocal in the UK over the last 18 months. And they have been making two key points. One is that there's a bunch of regulation that doesn't currently exist that they think should exist. So that requires getting the law changed. But also, these various rules and regulations we're alluding to here have generally not been enforced, which is one of the reasons why some touts who don't follow these rules have been able to get away with it.
Yeah.
And so that raises the question of, OK, over here we want some new laws passed by Parliament, but in the meantime, because that's always going to take quite a long time to go through the motions, how about we actually start enforcing the rules over here, whether they be the specific ticket touting rules or the consumer rights regulations that should apply to people reselling tickets.
And in one of the many government-commissioned reviews of the secondary ticketing market, the one by Professor Waterson did put in proposals for who should regulate and enforce those rules, and he decided that it should be National Trading Standards that did it.
Yes, one of the things that he said was that the police should concentrate on actual ticket fraud, so where people are claiming to have tickets to sell and they don't really, and then they just run off with the money. And he sort of said it's not particularly good use of the police's time to be going after touts who do generally have tickets to sell. They're just not following consumer rights laws. So therefore, this government agency, National Trading Standards, they should probably take responsibility for this. The problem there is, do they have resource? Do they have budget? And one of the things the government said on the back of the Waterson report was that they would try and provide a little bit more resource, a little bit more budget for National Trading Standards so that they could take responsibility for enforcing these various rules and regulations.
Yeah, so more than a year later, they've got around to it. Clearly, they have found that little bit of extra budget. And then last week, they not only raided four properties, they also arrested four people. So that's fun. And they seized a load of equipment as evidence.
So that's pretty much as we know. To quote National Trading Standards, what they said was that these raids are part of an ongoing investigation looking into unfair practices in the secondary ticketing market, and particularly the practices of businesses that buy and sell tickets in bulk. So a suitably vague statement.
Yes.
But nevertheless, it's interesting to see that there is a bit of a crackdown going on. The announcement from National Trading Standards follows an announcement a couple of weeks ago by the Competition and Markets Authority on secondary ticketing.
Yes, which said it was launching an investigation into the practices within the secondary ticketing websites with a view to enforcing the Consumer Rights Act rules. The focus there seemed to be more on the secondary ticketing websites, whereas it seems like this is more individual touts that the National Trading Standards are going after.
Yeah, both those government agencies, so National Trading Standards over here, the Competition and Markets Authority over here, when both those organisations put out statements confirming what they were doing in the secondary ticketing space, they keep stressing that they are liaising, okay? They're not doubling up. They are very much working on this together. But you're right, it does feel that probably the CMA is going to go after the secondary ticketing sites. So what responsibilities does StubHub, Viagogo, Seatwave, GetMeIn have in ensuring that these consumer rights rules are followed? One of the conversations that was had while Waterson was doing his review was the laws that have been passed in the 2015 Consumer Rights Act. Was it the job of individual touts to ensure those rules were followed, or were the sites obliged to ensure the rules were followed too? Waterson basically said the sites had some responsibility as well. So the CMA seemed to be focusing on whether or not the second ticketing sites are behaving, and alluded in its recent statement that, at least one of them wasn't. I think we can probably guess which one.
Yeah.
And you're right, National Trading Standards seem to be going less after the websites and more after the actual individuals who are using those sites in order to sell tickets.
One of the little things that happened in secondary ticketing last week was that StubHub gave an interview to BBC Newsbeat, which did read a lot like them preparing for the Competition and Markets Authority having this little investigation and crackdown. And basically just had a rep from StubHub saying over and over again, we're just a benign platform. We have no control over what anyone does in here. We just provide the platform and who knows what happens beyond that. He did claim that 98% of their users are just people who bought a ticket for something and then couldn't go to it, which, I mean, pick a number that's a bit more believable. Even if that's right, don't say 98%.
It may well be right. The key point is in that 2% of users is probably 98% of the tickets sold. You know, who's actually doing the selling is irrelevant. Of the tickets sold, how many are coming from individuals rather than companies? Because there is probably a very small group of industrial-level touts who account for a huge portion of the tickets that are being resold. But yeah, that did seem like a little bit of a bold statement to make. I thought the other interesting thing in that little Q&A that they did, one of the excuses that the secondary sites have always used over the years, whenever ticket touting has become controversial, is if you shut us down or if you overregulate so that the touts won't use our services anymore, then you'll send it all underground and people will start using websites outside of the UK where you then have none of the consumer protections that come from companies that are legitimately operating in the UK versus those that are operating who knows where in the world where none of those protections are offered. So therefore, better to have people using our services even if you don't like it versus those services abroad. But in this interview, they used a version of that excuse, but they talked about sending touts back onto the street and you'll just have more touts outside the venues. Like, physical touts outside the venues are ever going to sell the level of tickets.
And the prices.
That are being sold online. And I mean, you still occasionally get touts actually standing outside the venue. The live industry doesn't really care about those sorts of touts because realistically, the amount of business any one tout can do on the street, outside the venue, on the night is relatively nominal.
Also, the tout on the street doesn't come up to you and say, right, this ticket's going to cost you 400 quid. Oh, and also, you have to give a few hundred to this guy next to me for some reason.
It would be fun if they did. Perhaps that's going to be the next stage if they do super regulate all the sites. StubHub and Viagogo will start putting fencing up outside of venues with a little heater and a chair, and they'll say to touts, you can come and tout your tickets in our little corner with a heater and a chair, but we'll take 30% of the money. That would be a fun development in the touting world. So yeah, you can go and read Mr. StubHub's responses to Newsbeat's questions and see if you accept them.
Yeah, we'll link to those in the show notes for this show, setlistpodcast.com. That is all we have time for this week. You can find us on your social media of choice. If we're on there, we're setlistpod. You can also email us, setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by me, Andy Malt, and not me, Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, Setlist is an Unlimited production.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.